You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Zeg Zemda is one of South Africa's most prominent post-apartheid authors, and as the son of a prominent member of the African National Congress's Youth League, he's a self-confessed aristocrat of the revolution. To date, all of his novels have been set in South Africa, but in his latest book, he turns his attention to the United States. It's called Scion, published by Picador, and it brings Zeg Zemda to my show today. Hello.
Oh, hello.
And you revive one of the characters from your first novel, Ways of Dying,
yes.
Toloki.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Toloki or Tolokai?
Toloki, yes.
He's a professional mourner. What does a professional mourner do?
Well, I did not know, actually, when I wrote Ways of Dying, what a professional mourner did. In fact, I thought that I had invented that profession, you see, because in all the cultures of South Africa, there is no such thing as a professional mourner. But I wrote this book at a time when there was a lot of death happening in South Africa. It was during the time of the political transition. And I felt that we need, you know, a character who's going to mourn all those deaths that were happening at the time. I therefore invented this professional mourner.
Well, there are professional mourners in many cultures. People you hire to go to a funeral, and they wail louder than everyone else.
Yes, I only learned of that much later, you know, when people read the book and said, oh, so you also have professional mourners in your country. I said, no, but are they professional? They said, no, actually, you know, in some ancient cultures, you know, in Rome, in Greece, in Egypt, in Israel, I'm talking of the old Israel,
mm-hmm.
there were professional mourners. But even in some contemporary cultures, such as in Taiwan, for instance, they do have professional mourners.
Now, why bring him back? Because you see this as another time of dying?
Well, not quite. The reason that I brought him back, firstly, it was a suggestion that was made by a colleague of mine.
Mm. Well, he wasn't one of those characters, because some writers talk about characters who just sit in the back of your head, and sooner or later you just have to address their presence.
I never thought I would deal with Toloki again, you know. But this guy who loved my work so much, you know, asked me a question. Have you ever thought of taking Toloki from South Africa and placing him in a new culture altogether? At that time, in my mind, there was this new novel brewing, you know, set in Kilvet. Then I thought, yes, in fact, I will use Toloki as my focalizer, as my narrator in this novel. That's going to save me a lot of trouble because, you see, the story will be told from the perspective of this stranger. So if I say anything stupid in that novel, they will blame Toloki, not me.
That's right. You can always say, well, that wasn't me talking.
I
created this character.
Right.
And you brought him to Athens, Ohio, which also is where you live now.
Yes.
Do you find any similarities between Ohio and the home you left in South Africa?
Well, not many, except for the fact that the community that I write about, they are called the Win people by others. Win, W-I-N, which stands for White Indian Negro. Now, this is a community that emerged in the 1830s from the intermarriages of the Native Americans who lived in that area, the African slaves who were escaping from the South through Ohio to Canada. Many of them ended up in that village. And then also the Irish, mostly indentured workers, who also wanted to find a new life in Ohio. So these three groups came together in Kilvet, intermarried, and a new ethnic group emerged with a new wonderful syncretic culture, you know, that draws from the three mother cultures. So I was fascinated by this community. Why? Also because in South Africa, we do have such communities, in fact. you know, especially in the Western Cape and the Northern Cape.
Because there are a number of ethnic groups that were already indigenous, and then in came the Afrikaners and the British as well.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And Indians came in,
and
too.
Indians came in. Now, I'm thinking here particularly of some communities that you find in the Northern Cape, which emerged also around that period from the intermarriages of the Dutch and then the Khoi Khoi people, who are also known as the Hottentots, and the Black Africans. So the coming together of those three, you know, we had a new ethnic group actually emerging from that.
Which led to weird things under apartheid, where some people were called Bantu and other people were called coloreds, and
yes.
And they could be in the same family, so it got very odd.
But
how does that work with you with language? Because I don't know what language you grew up with, mm-hmm. but I suspect you have spoken two or three languages mm-hmm. during your lifetime. You write in English.
Yes.
Are the other languages, do you hear Afrikaans sometimes when you're writing, or what would be your tribal language if
well,
you spoke one?
You see, I grew up in a family where we spoke different languages. For instance, when we spoke with our father, we spoke in English. When we spoke with our mother, we spoke in Xhosa. Mm-hmm. When we spoke among ourselves, you know, siblings, with my siblings, we spoke in Sesotho. So right there were three languages spoken at home, you know. But then, of course, most of the things that we read were either in Xhosa, Sesotho, but also in English.
But how does that affect your approach to language? Because I would assume that enriches language in some people and confuses others.
Well, in my view, I think it enriches language because, you see, all these different languages that I speak have wonderful, you know, oral traditions. They also have wonderful, you know, idiomatic expressions, and all these find their way in my English. So when you read my novels, for instance, which are in English, it's not really English as she is spoke in England. You know, it's English with very strong African idioms, African expressions, actually, what one would call transliteration.
Is this one of the reasons that quilting plays a part in this story? Because to some degree, we're talking about a bunch of different things all making up something that is unique in itself.
Yes, because in fact, the community in Kilvert, you know, that is the setting of this novel, is a quilting community. And many women there, you'll find that they have quilts that they've inherited from their great-great-grandmothers, you know, pre-Civil War quilts that they still keep there. And they continue the tradition even today, quilting, you know, the designs, the traditional designs. So I was fascinated by this tradition. That is why even when I told my story, you know, I told it in patches like that, which I quilted together.
My guest is Zakes Mda, M-D-A. His latest book, Cion, C-I-O-N, is published by Picador. And you interweave stories from the past, the slaves, with the current situation, this contemporary story of the Quigleys, and mm-hmm. Toliki, the main character, stays with the Quigleys and
yes.
immediately becomes aware that there's a conflict within the family, and that
yes.
conflict is this mixed racial heritage?
Yes, because you see, the people there are very proud of their heritage, very proud. But also, you find that over the years, now I'm talking of the real life situation in Kilvert, which I also try to portray in my novel. Over the years, they've been marginalized, you know. They evolved on their own there. That is why sociologists refer to them as triracial isolates, because, you know, they evolved in that isolation there. So my main character then, Toloki, is welcomed by this family. And immediately then, he learns many things about the heritage of this family, of which they are very proud. That is why then, through the portal of quilts, we are able to go back in history and trace their ancestors and trace how these Africans escaped from Virginia across the river to Ohio. We trace also how the Irishman left Ireland via New York, found himself in Virginia, and then in Ohio.
Mm. Well, many people will say that the past shapes the present, but you say the present shapes the past.
Yes. You see, in my previous works, because, you see, I've always been fascinated by history. So in my previous works, you'll find that I am always trying to show that the past is always a strong presence in our present. And I thought initially when I was writing this novel, this would follow the same trend. Only to discover that, in fact, in Kilvet, the people there are always creating and recreating their past. They are always transforming the past in order to validate their present, in order to palliate their present.
Your title is spelled C-I-O-N, which is a variant of the more common spelling of the
yes.
word Scion, S-C-I-O-N. I guess that could also be applied to you, a descendant or an heir, because you're an heir to the anti-apartheid struggle.
Yes.
But should I be surprised that a Scion of the South African Revolution is living in Athens, Ohio?
Well, I don't think so, because this Scion has lived everywhere, you know, from the days when I was a refugee. The world has been my home.
Mm. You had to live outside the country
I
during
had to
the years
deliver.
When your father was considered an enemy of the state.
Definitely, yes. But then now, of course, I'm able to go to South Africa. You know, I spend 5 months of every year in South Africa working in various developmental projects there. Then 7 months in Ohio teaching creative writing.
Another South African writer, Nig Mshlongo, says that the era of struggle literature is over in South Africa. Do you agree?
Well, in a way, if we are talking of struggle against apartheid. But then, of course, I mean, there will always be, you know, various struggles, you know. The only difference now is that, whereas in the past, apartheid, you know, was predominant in the themes that we wrote about. And for a reason, because, you see, apartheid was predominant in all aspects of life. You could not write a love story without touching on apartheid. Why? Because in real life out there, apartheid touched on the loves of people. It determined who you could love, who you could not love, where you should live, where you should not live.
And how you could travel.
How you could travel. Everything. What job you can do and what job you cannot do because of the color of your skin. So you will find that then. That is why apartheid dominated every story that we wrote. It's because in real life it was like that. So now we no longer have that predominant theme. We have various struggles now. There are some of us who will write art for its own sake, who will write art just for mere entertainment, and that is wonderful that we are able to do that. But there are others who address other struggles, who will address gender issues, who will address, you know, issues pertaining to AIDS, and many other struggles that we are still involved in.
And there's a certain expectation that these big stories will be told. There was an article in the New York Times a while ago that suggested that this is the time for the great South African novel. But I remember the American novelist Norman Rush, who's written about Botswana,
yes.
Was critical of you for not addressing the AIDS issue in
yes.
one of your earlier books.
Uh-huh.
And I get the feeling you're saying, well, you don't always have to do that.
Well, I mean, that was nonsense, because he's determining what themes I should write about. I'm free. I write about anything I want to write about. It so happened that the novels he was criticizing for not addressing AIDS, had nothing to do with AIDS, you see. And that
but I guess he feels that the South African writer should be dealing with South Africa has so much of such a terrible AIDS problem.
Firstly, it was during the period when, you know, there was no AIDS in South Africa yet when I wrote the novel. But even if there was AIDS, we don't live and breathe AIDS all the time. We have other aspects of life that we deal with in South Africa, you see, that we do write about. Secondly, Norman Rush has never asked J.M. Coetzee, for instance, why he has not written about AIDS, you know, or he has never asked Nadine Gordimer, you know. He asked me as a black writer because AIDS is my thing as a black person. So that was rubbish. Not only that, I mean, the mere fact that when you are reviewing a book, then you want to determine what this writer should be writing about, you know, instead of judging the book on its own merit.
Just one more thing. The book is, this novel, Cion, C-I-O-N, is set on the eve of the 2004 U.S. presidential election.
Yes.
We are at the beginning of the campaign for the next election,
right?
The one in 2008. Do you think America's changed in the 4 years since you wrote about it?
Well, it's difficult for me to say, you know.
Well, you live here half the year.
I live here.
I'm sure you read the newspapers and think about what's going on here.
I live here half the year. But, you know, I only came here actually to stay in 2002. So to say since then up to now it has changed would be a difficult assessment for me to make. What I observe, of course, is that especially, you know, in places where I come from, you know, we seem to be becoming all America, the America that I see, seems to be becoming more and more conservative than it was, for instance, when I first came here.
Well, maybe that's Ohio.
Yes.
Zakes Mda's latest book is set in the United States, his first novel set outside of South Africa. It's called Cion, C-I-O-N, published by Picador, and it has been my great honor to have him on my show today.
It's my pleasure.
And as I said earlier, Zakes Mda will be in conversation with Edwige Dantica tonight at 8 at the 92nd Street Y. For details, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, Michael Korda explains why he thinks that historians have underestimated Dwight D. Eisenhower's political accomplishments. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.